Jonathan Harker has arrived in Germany on his way to Transylvania. He innocently believes that his objective is to finalize a property purchase in London with one Count Dracula. Mr. Harker soon discovers that he is the unwitting subject of the forces of good and evil.
May 1st, 1897, Munich. As we prepared for our drive, the sun was shining brightly. The streets were full with gypsies bargaining their wares, and in the air was the joyousness of early summer. Herr Delbruck, the maitre d'hôtel of the Quatre Saisons where I was staying, came down bareheaded to the carriage.
Ah! Mr. Harker, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Herr Delbruck.
You are going for a drive, I see.
And I trust a tour of your countryside will prove as satisfying as the lodgings you provided.
You are too kind, mein Herr. It is always a pleasure to serve a gentleman. If you will excuse me, I must have a word with your driver.
Johann appears a capable horseman.
He is a peasant, mein Herr, and peasants live by their fears. But he is obedient. Johann, kommst du her?
Ja, mein Herr.
Johann, remember, you are back by nightfall. The sky looks bright, but there is a shiver in the north wind that says there may be a sudden storm. But I am sure you will not be late, for you know what night it is.
Ja, mein Herr.
Do you understand what I am saying to you?
Ja, mein Herr.
Good. Now go. And be on your guard.
We drove off as Johann started the horses at a quick pace. In a short while, we had cleared the town and were driving in the German countryside. Johann seemed anxious and nervous as he drove the horses. I could not help but feel that it had something to do with Herr Delbruck's reference to this being some special night. Johann? I say, Johann!
Mein Herr?
Tell me, Johann, what is tonight?
Tonight ist Walpurgisnacht.
As Herr Delbruck had said, the peasants live by their fears. In preparation for this visit to Count Dracula, I had made a study of local customs and beliefs, and it served me well. Walpurgisnacht was no simple matter to this man. According to the belief of millions of people, on this night the devil was abroad. And on this night the graves were opened, and the dead came forth. All evil things of earth and air and water held revel. And will the dead walk tonight, Johann?
Mein Herr?
I asked if you believe the dead will walk tonight.
To speak of it is dangerous, mein Herr.
Ah, Johann. To be afraid of such witches' tales is foolish.
And what is it? Do not fear the beast.
What's that you say?
Nothing, mein Herr. It is a saying of peasants.
Why, yes. Of course. Johann drove the carriage at a strong pace, although there was no apparent need to hurry. Every now and then, the horses seemed to throw up their heads and sniff the air suspiciously. On such occasions, I often looked round in alarm. The road was pretty bleak. We were traversing a sort of high, windswept plateau. As we drove, I saw a road that looked but little used, and which seemed to dip through a little winding valley. It looked so inviting that even at the risk of offending Johann, I called for him to stop. And when he had pulled up, I told him I would like him to drive down that road. He made all sorts of excuses, and frequently crossed himself as he spoke.
No, please, mein Herr. There is no time.
Well, Johann, I want to go down this road. I shall not ask you to come unless you like, but tell me why you do not like to go. That is all I ask.
Please, no. The sun will set very soon.
Is that a wolf?
It sounds like a wolf, but yet there are no wolves here now.
No? Do wolves come so near the city?
the snow and the wolves come together to the city.
But it's barely summer.
Perhaps that was not a wolf.
The sunshine passed away. Dark clouds moved rapidly across the sky, and a breath of cold wind seemed to drift past us. It was only a breath, however, and more in the nature of a warning than a fact, for the sun came out brightly again. Johann looked under his lifted hand at the horizon and said,
"The storm of snow, he comes before long time."
Johann, tell me about this place where the road leads.
It is unholy.
What is unholy?
The village.
Then there is a village.
No, no one is alive in that place.
But you said there was a village.
There was. There is.
I see no village. Where is it?
Here, in this place. Hundreds of years ago, many died and were buried in graves. Then from the graves, voices called, and there were sounds from under the clay. When the graves are opened, there were men and women, rosy with life, mouths red with blood. And so, to save their lives and their souls, those who were left fled away to other places, where the living lived and the dead were dead and not dead.
Not dead?
Not dead.
He trembled as he spoke. It seemed as if his imagination had got hold of him, and he stood in a perfect paroxysm of fear, white-faced, perspiring, trembling, and looking round him as if expecting that some dreadful presence would manifest itself there in the bright sunshine and the open plain. You are afraid, Johann. You are afraid. You may go. I shall return alone. The walk will do me good. I intend to see this village, and I assure you that Walpurgis Night is for fools and peasants and does not concern Englishmen.
Ein Mann ohne Angst ist ein Tor.
What's that you say?
Only a peasant's blessing, mein Herr.
As Johann turned his horses toward Munich, I leaned on my stick and looked after him. He went slowly along the road for a while. Then there came over the crest of the hill a man, tall and thin. When this man drew near the horses, they began to jump and kick about, then to scream with terror. Johann could not hold them in, and they bolted down the road, running away madly. I watched them out of sight and then looked for the stranger, but I found that he too was gone. I turned down the side road through the deepening valley, to which Johann had objected. There was not the slightest reason that I could see for his objection, and I dare say I tramped for a couple of hours without thinking of time or distance, and certainly without seeing a person or house. So far as the place was concerned, it was desolation itself, but I did not notice this particularly until, on turning a bend in the road, I came upon a scattered fringe of wood. Then I recognized that I had been impressed unconsciously by the desolation of the region through which I had passed. The ground I passed over now was much more picturesque, and overall there was a charm of beauty. I sat down to rest myself and began to look around. It struck me that it was considerably colder than it had been at the commencement of my walk. Also, a sort of sighing sound seemed to be all round me, with now and then, high overhead, a sort of muffled roar. Looking upwards, I noticed that great thick clouds were drifting rapidly across the sky from north to south, at a great height. There were signs of a coming storm in some lofty stratum of the air. I was a little chilly, and thinking that it was the sitting still after the exercise of walking, I resumed my journey. I took little heed of time, and it was only when the deepening twilight forced itself upon me that I began to think of how I should find my way home. The brightness of the day had gone. But I had said I would see the deserted village, so on I went, and presently came on a wide stretch of open country, shut in by hills all around. Their sides were covered with trees, which spread down to the plain, dotting in clumps the gentler slopes and hollows which showed here and there. I followed with my eye the winding of the road and saw that it curved close to one of the densest of these clumps and was lost behind it. As I looked, there came a cold shiver in the air, and the snow began to fall. I thought of the miles and miles of bleak country I had passed, and then hurried on to seek the shelter of the wood. Darker and darker grew the sky. Then the wind grew stronger and blew with ever-increasing force till I was fain to run before it. The snow was now falling so thickly that I could hardly keep my eyes open. The blackness of the storm had become merged in the darkness of the night, and every now and then the heavens were torn asunder by vivid lightning. And in the flashes I could see ahead of me a great mass of trees, chiefly yew and cypress, all heavily coated with snow. Scattered among the trees were ancient foundations of stone. Perhaps amongst so many old foundations there might still be standing a house in which, though in ruins, I could find some sort of shelter for a while. As I skirted the edge of the copse, I found that a low wall encircled it, and following this I presently found an opening. Just then the drifting clouds obscured the moon, and I passed upon a path in darkness. The wind must have grown colder, for I felt myself shiver as I walked. But there was hope of shelter, and I groped my way blindly on. I stopped, for there was a sudden stillness, and perhaps in sympathy with nature's silence, my heart seemed to cease to beat. But this was only momentarily, for suddenly the moonlight broke through the clouds, showing me that I was in a graveyard, and before me was a great massive tomb of marble, as white as the snow that lay on and all around it. With the moonlight there came a fierce sigh of the storm which appeared to resume its course. I was awed and shocked, and felt the cold perceptibly grow upon me till it seemed to grip me by the heart. Then, while the flood of moonlight still fell on the marble tomb, I approached the sepulchre to see what it was and why such a thing stood alone in such a place. I walked around it, and read over the Doric door in German, "Countess Dolligan of Graz, in Styria, sought and found death, 1801. On the top of the tomb, seemingly driven through the solid marble, for the structure was composed of a few vast blocks of stone, was a great iron spike or stake. On going to the back, I saw graven in great Russian letters, "The dead travel fast." There was something so weird and uncanny about the whole thing that it gave me a turn and made me feel quite faint. I began to wish for the first time that I had taken Johann's advice. Here a thought struck me, which came under almost mysterious circumstances and with a terrible shock. This was Walpurgis Night. Walpurgis Night, when graves were opened and the dead came forth, and I was here in this very place Johann had specially shunned. This was the horrible village of centuries ago where so many were dead and not dead. Now a perfect tornado burst upon me. The ground shook as though thousands of horses thundered across it, and this time the storm bore on its icy wings not snow, but great hailstones. Hailstones that beat down leaf and branch and made the shelter of the cypresses of no more avail than a standing corn. First I had rushed to the nearest tree, but I was soon fain to leave it and seek the only spot that seemed to afford refuge. The deep doorway of the marble tomb. As I leaned against the door, it moved slightly and opened inwards. The shelter of even a tomb was welcome in that pitiless tempest, and I was about to enter it when there came a flash of forked lightning that lit up the whole expanse of the heavens. In the instant, as I am a living man, I saw, as my eyes were turned into the darkness of the tomb, a beautiful woman with rounded cheeks and red lips, seemingly sleeping on a bier. As the thunder broke overhead, I was grasped by the hand of a great giant and hurled out into the storm. I had a strange, dominating feeling that I was not alone. I looked towards the tomb. Just then, there came another blinding flash and seemed to strike the iron stake that surmounted the tomb and to pour through to the earth, blasting and crumbling the marble as in a burst of flame. The dead woman rose for a moment of agony while she was lapped in the flame, and her bitter scream of pain was drowned in the thunder crash. A sort of vague beginning of consciousness, then a sense of weariness that was dreadful. For a time, I remembered nothing, but slowly my senses returned. My feet seemed positively racked with pain, yet I could not move them. They seemed to be numbed. There was an icy feeling at the back of my neck and all down my spine, and my ears, like my feet, were dead, yet in torment, but there was in my breast a sense of warmth which was by comparison delicious. I felt some heavy weight on my chest which made it difficult to breathe. Then came a sort of loathing, like the first stage of seasickness, and a wild desire to be free from something, I knew not what. A vast stillness enveloped me, as though all the world were asleep or dead, only broken by the low panting as of some animal close to me. I felt a warm rasping at my throat. Then came a consciousness of the awful truth, which chilled me to the heart and sent the blood surging up through my brain. Some great animal was lying on me. And now, licking my throat. I feared to stir. Some instinct of prudence bade me lie still, but the brute seemed to realize that there was now some change in me, for it raised its head. Through my eyelashes, I saw above me two great flaming eyes of a gigantic wolf. Its sharp white teeth gleamed in the gaping red mouth, and I could feel its hot breath fierce backward upon me. For another spell of time, I remembered no more. Then, seemingly very far away, I heard many voices calling in unison. Cautiously, I raised my head and looked in the direction whence the sound came, but the cemetery blocked my view. Then, all at once, from beyond the trees, there came at a trot a troop of horsemen bearing torches. The wolf rose from my breast and made for the cemetery. At a gallop, the troop rode forward, some towards me, others following the wolf as it disappeared amongst the snow-clad cypresses. As they drew nearer, I tried to move, but was powerless, although I could see and hear all that went on around me. Two of the soldiers jumped from their horses and knelt beside me. Some brandy was poured down my throat. It put vigor into me. Lights and shadows were moving among the trees, and I could hear men call to one another. They drew together, uttering frightened exclamations, and the lights flashed as the others came pouring out of the cemetery, pell-mell, like men possessed. When the further ones came close to us, one of those who was with me asked,
"Did you see him?"
"No, no. Come away, quick. This is no place to stay. And on this, of all nights..."
"What was it? Was it him?"
"It was a wolf. And yet, not a wolf. Without the sacred bullet, there is no use trying for him."
"Serves us right for coming out on this night. Truly, we have earned our 1,000 marks.
There was blood on the broken marble. Fresh blood. And for him, is he safe? Look at his throat. See, the wolf has been lying on him and keeping his blood warm."
"He is all right. The skin is not pierced. What does it all mean? We should never have found him but for the call of the wolf.
What became of it?
It went to its home. There are graves enough there in which it may lie. Come, comrade. Let us leave this cursed spot.
The soldier raised me to a sitting posture as he uttered a word of command. Then several men placed me upon a horse. With a word to advance, we rode away in swift military order. The next thing I remember was finding myself standing in front of the Quatre Saisons, supported by a soldier on each side of me. It was almost broad daylight, and to the north a red streak of sunlight was reflected like a path of blood over the countryside. As Herr Delbruck approached, the officer was telling the men to say nothing of what they had seen, except that they had found an English stranger, guarded by a large dog.
Ah, dog. That was no dog. I think I know a wolf when I see one.
Don't be a fool. I said a dog.
Look at his throat. Is that the walk of a dog?
As I said, it was a dog. If the truth were told, we should only be laughed at.
My young friend.
Herr Delbruck, how was it that the soldiers searched for me?
Ah, I was so fortunate as to obtain leave from the commander of the regiment in which I served to ask for volunteers.
But how did you know I was lost?
The driver came hither with the remains of his carriage, which had been upset when the horses ran away.
And you sent a search party of soldiers merely on this account?
No, my young friend. Even before the coachman arrived, I had this telegram from the boyar whose guest you are.
He took from his pocket a telegram, which he handed to me, and I read.
Be careful of my guest. His safety is most precious to me. Should aught happen to him, or if he be missed, spare nothing to find him and ensure his safety. He is English. Therefore, adventurous. There are often dangers from snow and wolves and night. Lose not a moment if you suspect harm to him. I answer your zeal with my fortune. Dracula!
As I held the telegram in my hand, the room seemed to whirl around me, and if the attentive maitre d'hotel had not caught me, I think I should have fallen. There was something so strange in all this, something so weird and impossible to imagine, that there grew on me a sense of my being, in some way, the sport of opposite forces, the mere vague idea of which seemed in a way to paralyze me. I was certainly under some form of mysterious protection. From a distant country had come, in the very nick of time, a message that took me out of the danger of the snow sleep and the jaws of the wolf.